Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 18, delivered on October 25, 2018. The title of this lecture is Measures of Risk.
Tonight, Metrics of Risk, Measures of Risk. So the thing is that with the stock market as it is now, we have more down days, more up days, large down, large up. That's what I was talking about when I talked about the concept of volatility of the markets. The volatility of the markets is greater. In other words, the range of outcomes is larger now. That's what we mean essentially by volatility. Prices going down, prices going up. Returns is actually something I should point out is typically, we talk more about returns than we do about prices themselves. We look at the return annualized of a stock or a portfolio, year to year or month to month. And that's where we see this volatility. The returns on the portfolios are beginning to get pretty wild. Now, moving forward a little bit, sir, would you say that you are risk-averse or risk-loving?
I'm risk-averse.
You are risk-averse. In other words, you want a higher return if you are going to take on greater risk. Now, there are entities, most of us are risk-averse. We actually avoid risk, and if we are to take risk, we anticipate that there is going to be some reward for that. Now, risk neutral, you don't care whether it's high volatility or low volatility. That's just your way. You're not going to really expect anything. Now, risk preferring, you actually are willing to take risk. You want risk. You look forward to risk. You might even be willing to take a lower return for a higher risk. We hope that's not the case with too many people. But in other words, if I were to measure beta against expected return to your portfolio, a risk-averse person would have an upward-sloping line. A risk-averse person. This, by the way, is called the security market line. If you want no risk, then all you're going to get is the risk-free rate. And at a beta of 1, you're going to get the expected return to the market portfolio. Okay? That'd be a normal person. Now, a risk-neutral person would have a flat line. They don't want any more reward. They don't care. A risk-preferring person would actually have a downward-sloping line. But remember this, in a normal world, in order to get a higher expected return, you have to take higher risk. And as I said, there are actually risk seekers, people who want risk because they're still risk averse, don't get me wrong, but they want to take that risk so that they can get that very high expected return. They are the opposite side of the market to those who want to avoid risk. So in other words, there are risk takers. They are still risk averse. Don't get me wrong about that. But they want, they'll take your risk for a fee. They'll take it off your hands. But the typical securities market line looks like this. A beta of 0, riskless. All you're going to get is a treasury bill rate. At a beta of the market portfolio, that by definition is the expected return to the market. Now, your expected return, your what we call the market premium. The market premium is the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. In other words, it's the additional reward you get for taking the risk of the market instead of avoiding all risk. You're going to college, aren't you, ma'am? So you'll come out of here maybe making about $60,000 a year. Now, if you went right out of high school, didn't take the risk of spending money on college, you'd make about $20,000 a year, okay? So $40,000 is your premium for bearing the risk. And that's what we mean. The expected return to the market portfolio right now, maybe about 9%. The annualized return on a very short-term safe treasury bill is about 2%. So the market premium is 7%. That's your additional reward for taking risk instead of no risk. Okay? If you understand that, the homework is actually not that hard at all, but I do want to bring up a couple of major important issues. Look. I'm sure you saw in your statistics class, or as we used to call them, the sadistics class, the normal distribution. Now, a wide distribution represents more risk, a larger standard deviation. A narrow distribution tends to be tighter, like this. In both cases, this is your expected value, the center. And then the dispersion of it is your standard deviation, how widely spread it is. Consider this. There's a problem with saying stock prices are normally distributed. Stock prices can't be normally distributed because a normal distribution always gives positive probability to negative value. There's always some chance of negative, and you can't have a negative stock price, although God knows some companies have tried. So we really don't want to talk too much about stock prices. We talk about stock returns, which can be negative. Okay, so that's an important thing to consider. Now, another thing. This is a sample average. Sample average, or if you want to use fancy terminology, the sample mean. If you are doing a population, we would use the symbol, the Greek symbol mu. But we generally do not use populations. We're sampling data. Because in order to sample to get to the population, you'd have billions of numbers. So we're almost always going to be in a sampling situation. That means that all you do is, for a straight up flat average, you just add them up and divide. For a weighted average, you take the weight of each one times the data point. But also, the standard deviation, and I strongly encourage you, and I'll show you how to do this on your I'm going to pull up Excel tonight and show you this. The standard deviation for the sample, which is what we almost always are going to be using, it's going to be the square root of the sum of the each data point minus the average squared over n minus 1. Now, if you're using a population, we wouldn't say S, we'd use sigma. Although I think in the book, most books they use sigma, but technically if you're in a stats or a probability theory course, the sample standard deviation is almost always shown by an S instead of a sigma. But I think in these books they just show sigma for it. Now, what was I going to say here? Okay, that's fine. This is a pain in the butt to do. But in Excel, it is so easy. For the average, all you will do is just say equals average of, say, A1 through A40 or whatever it is, your data vector. The standard deviation, if you're going to do it in Excel, you've got to do the right standard deviation because there are several functions you can use. The one that you're going to want to use almost always is STDEV of the data vector. If you do have a real population, you would want to put STDEV.P. Very important for you to know that. Don't use .P unless you are sure you're actually using a population of data and not a sample. So in other words, when I take an average of you, it is a sample of all students. When I take the standard deviation, it's a sample of all students. So I would use the STDEV. Now, there's also an average you can use for weighted averages as well. You show it the weights and the numbers side by side in those parentheses. Not much there to talk about. However, there's something important under the surface of this that we've got to talk about too. The problem is that, let's say that your average of your stock returns is 40%, and your standard deviation is, say, 15%. And let's say you've got another portfolio that has an average return of, let's say, 10%, and a standard deviation of 20%, or 15%, or whatever. Do you see that those two standard deviations are not compatible? Because one is starting from a much lower value. 15% dispersion on 10% returns is a hellaciously greater number than a 15% spread on returns of 40%. We need to make a correction to take care of this. It's called the coefficient of variation, the CV. It's just the standard deviation divided by the mean. This takes away the scale of the numbers. Yeah.
Okay, so it corrects for the scale of the numbers?
Yes, for the size of the numbers. And this is something you should always, always do. Even if you're, even when you're doing things like marketing data, you got two different groups and you're looking at the data for each of these two groups. Don't look at the spread as a standard deviation. Look at the CV. So in other words, if I'm looking some kind of marketing data where I have the weights of men and women, how much they weigh, the standard deviation of the men's weight and the standard deviation of the women's weight might very well be the same. But because women's weights on average are lower than men's weights, the standard deviations have to be adjusted to look at CVs. In other words, divide by the, where the center of the data is. Okay? Now, one other thing that I should point out here. These averages are what we call measures of central tendency. Measures of central tendency. There's a problem with using an average on its own, especially if your data is not normally distributed. Let me give you an example. Now, another measure of central tendency is the median. The median is the place where half the data lies below, half the data lies above. With a normal distribution, the mean and the median are identical. That's where it can get very interesting, though. Because let me show you your information from your test. The median, the average of your scores, the raw scores, was 74. The median of the scores was 79. So, in other words, your test scores were not normally distributed. Half of the data was below 79, and half of the data was above 79. And yet, the average of the scores was 74. How does that happen? Yeah. Which way? The low, in other words, I had a few really low scores. Really low scores that dragged down the average. You see, the cool thing about the median is it's not sensitive to outliers, as you call them. So, in other words, in this case, what I can see is that, yeah, I had a few students who dragged down the average because they got scores of like 9, 12. There were a couple of 19s and a few 24s. But everyone else was doing really well, doing quite decently. So I have to look at both of these, and I say, okay, that was a problem with just the outliers. Now, interestingly enough, by the end of the course, what's going to happen is that I'll see this is very typical at the end of the course. Do you see how it becomes more normally distributed as the course goes on? Why? Does anyone know why? What? Yeah. Well, there's more data, but there's something much, much more important. Yeah. Yahtzee. Yeah. If you got a 19 on the first test, you're going to say FTS. Fancy that scenario. You're going to leave. You're going to quit. You're going to say, nope, I'm going to change my major to fine arts so I don't have a job for the rest of my life. I shouldn't say that. Yes, I should. I know, right? Yeah. Fortunately, I've been working with some people. We're trying to get this double major, fine arts of business, or the business of fine arts. So that there are probably students in this class who are actually minoring in business, and they're taking this course as part of a concentration. But I think it would be better if we just did a major in it. And yeah, that's actually, we're talking about some very interesting creative processes now, trying to get more creativity into business, because that's one of the problems is we have the wrong kind of creativity. It's called financial engineering now. Anyway, so keep that in mind, that when you look at data, it's actually kind of important for you to know how to do. I learned this rule. I actually have part of my field, high-powered field is mathematical probability. It's called econometrics, and it's such intense math, you can't even tell it's math, and the symbols are so weird. But there's a rule that was taught to me years ago. Either use the most complicated math on earth or use the simplest math on earth when you're doing statistics. And I've learned that. Just use some simple stats, and you're going to get a lot of answers. Don't try to get fancy with regressions and ANOVA tables and all that. Just use simple statistics, and you'll see the kinds of stuff that you want to know. The problem, though, is that in a lot of cases, when we talk about risk, standard deviation is fine to talk about. Coefficient of variation is fine to talk about. Beta is fine to talk about. But there are some aspects of risk that are more complex. So in that regard, one of those I have to do as a demonstration to you. Now, this demonstration is going to require someone to help me. But it starts No, I don't want to come on. Come on, come on, come on, get out of there. Go on. Okay.
They're not even dinosaurs.
They're not dinosaurs. No, they're not, fool. What are these?
I don't know.
Yeah. Something. Yeah. See? Look. Dragon. Oh.
Ah.
Oh, no, no, no. I mean, I've got a My Little Pony dragon. Hey. Dragons. Okay? Not only are they dragons, they're miniature dragons. Oh, that was nasty. Those two were doing... perverts. Okay, so now I'm going to have to do the demonstration. It's very important for what's going to happen. Sir, attack!
Oh, jeez, I'm terrified.
You were just attacked by a whole herd of dragons.
Mm-hmm. You want them back now?
You don't touch my dragons, man. Okay, he was attacked by many, many dragons. Mini dragons, miniature dragons. But what happens now... a real giant. Wait, whoa. Fire-breathing dragon. Frequency, mini dragons versus severity. A single giant dragon. Oh, my face is on fire. Oh, God. Do you see the difference between frequency and severity?
Right. Fire was a severe
dragon. Well, no, never mind the fire, fool. We're talking about a fire-breathing dragon attacking him versus a bunch of little mini dragons, wannabe giant dragons, that were just and attacking him. Did you get them all? There's one right there. That's a good one. That's a good dragon.
There you go.
Okay, frequency versus... It's a different deal. It's a different kind of risk than you're in a spaceship and you go out for a spacewalk. You got all these little micrometeoroids, you know, thousands. And there's a problem there. And then you look, it's an asteroid. Boom. That's a big difference, right? Okay. Real finance for real people. That's what it's about in this class. You follow? Good. Now, I'm going to show you something. I'm going to show you a little Excel, and I'm going to show you some mad skills. Now, I tried this, and I know usually it does not work. But I'm going to give it a shot again here. And let me show you something here. Nope, that's not the one I want. And I'll pulse. Nope, not that one. I'm going to try to find it again here. Should have kept it from the last time. Do one more page this way. Now, stock returns. Uh, Wait, let me do this. I know how I can get back to where I was. I'm looking for the historical stock returns. I'm not seeing the one that I want here real quick, but I will find it here, I'm sure. See if I can find it here. Oh, here we go, maybe. There it is. There's my data. See that right there? I have the stock returns for the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ from 1975 to 2017. Now, I want you to watch how I do this. And I don't think it's going to work on this computer because there's these blockers on it that keep you from doing data. But what you're going to see is an actual use of big data in Excel. I'm going to bring up an Excel spreadsheet. Now, watch what I'm going to do here. I'm going to go to data, and I'm just going to say, well, first of all, let me do something real quick here. You see this URL, this web address for all this data? I'm going to copy that address, www.onestock.com/onestock1_142.htm. I'm going to copy that web address. And I'll need that in a minute because what I'm going to do is I've gone to in Excel to data, get external data from the web. Now, it's going to ask me to give it the site to go to. Right up here. So I'm going to paste that URL in there and say go. Now it's going to give me scripting errors. Yep, see it? Yes. Just say yes to the scripting errors. Just keep saying yes because it's trying to block this from happening. And we're going to just keep saying yes until it gets tired of asking. Okay, good. Now, once you've gotten past the script errors, it's going to show you little arrows where it identifies data. Now, the one at the top is almost always going to be there. That's the menu bar that looks to Excel like a data vector. Just ignore that one. But looky there. It's saying, is this the table you want, that little yellow box with the arrow in it? You say, yes, that is exactly the table I want. You click on that little yellow arrow, and then you say import. And it's going to say, okay, where do you want that to start? At A1? Yep. Boom. There's all your data. Can you imagine having to type that in one column at a time? This is big data. When they say, can you do big data? This is one of the things they want to know if you can do, and it's not that hard. Now, if this doesn't work, you can always do what we call the cheapo approach and just simply copy the data as a giant data vector and say, you know, copy all this, copy, and then just say paste it. See, it'll do the same thing. You can do it either way. And you're saying, well, why wouldn't you do it that? Isn't that way easier than all the scripting errors? Yeah, except that with the import, the data pull, what's called a data pull approach, as the web page updates, you can go in and just say update the data vector that you originally pulled from the site. That's why that first way, even though it's a pain in the butt when you get those scripting errors, it's still superior if you are in a dynamic environment where you need to have your data updated regularly. Okay, so anyway, one way or the other. One way or the other. Let's go back here. Matter of fact, I'll just use this data. I might as well. It's prettier. The one thing about copying the data is it copies the format nicely, too. So what we're going to do here now is we are going to calculate the average, the median, the standard deviation, and the coefficient of variation. For each of these, left aligning them. Okay, so now, the way I'll do it is I'll just say equals average, open the parenthesis, and I'll just go grab it. That's A2 through A44. I'll remember that. Oops, no. B2 through B44, I'm sorry. Okay, now the median would equal median, open parenthesis, B2 through B44. Standard deviation, STDEV, B2 through... Oh, yeah, equal, thank you, equals standard deviation. By the way, notice STDEVP is offered as a possibility. Don't use it. That's a population, and we don't have the whole data vector. We have a sample of it. DEV, B2 through B44. And the coefficient of variation will equal the standard deviation divided by the average. Now, I'm going to alter these so that they are percentages, format the cells, percentages to two decimal places. And the coefficient of variation is a pure number, so I'll format that to a number with two decimal places. Okay. And then what I'm going to do is just take these four and just grab the handle at the bottom, and there they are. Looky there. That's not hard to do, and I strongly, strongly recommend in those problems in the homework, they give you these data tables. Unfortunately, you can't copy them. It's a flash thing. But you can quickly put that, just throw it quickly into an Excel spreadsheet. You get your answers, and you're not going to make a mistake like you can when you do arithmetic. I am terrible at doing those standard deviations because I'm constantly forgetting to do a closed parentheses or something like that. But anyway, let's talk turkey here. This is the Dow, this is the Standard & Poor's 500, and this is the NASDAQ. What do you notice about the return of the Dow versus the Standard & Poor's versus the NASDAQ? Which is the safest portfolio? Which would be the safest, the lowest risk portfolio? Can you tell me, ma'am? This is not hard. Yes, the 30 largest companies on earth. They are not going to die. They live forever. They're just giant dinosaurs. Safest, the S&P 500. 500 monopolistically competitive, big, big companies. It's a riskier portfolio. The NASDAQ. Thousands and thousands of scrappy little companies and a few giants in there, but it's a big pile of risk. Do you notice the relationship between risk and return historically? As you go up the scale of the risk, you get a higher historical return. What I've been talking about all along, it's right there in the data. You want greater return? Well, you're going to probably have to take more risk. You don't invest in the Dow portfolio, you invest in the Standard & Poor's. Okay, now, notice the standard deviation. The spread of the data is wider. In other words, greater risk. Well, spank me. But there's an interesting thing when you look at the coefficient of variation. Something is quite interesting about the CV. Do you notice, sir, that the Dow and the Standard & Poor's, their coefficients of variation are the same? In other words, on a scaled basis, scaled by the returns, the Standard & Poor's is no riskier than the Dow. In other words, which would be a better portfolio, the Dow or the Standard & Poor's? Yeah, the S&P, because you're getting actually no more scaled risk with the 500 largest companies than you are with the 30 largest companies, which actually kind of makes sense because both of them are the giants of the earth. The Dow and the Standard & Poor's both represent the majority of the capitalization of the entire planet's economy. So, of course, they're probably going to have, on a measured, scaled basis, about the same risk, the risk of the world. The NASDAQ, on the other hand, yeah, that's a riskier portfolio. But you notice that actually, on this basis, it's not all that much riskier. So if you're looking for greater expected return, you're probably going to do a NASDAQ portfolio instead of a Standard & Poor's portfolio. You're going to take more risk, so you've got to take that into account. But in any of these cases, your diversification of risk in any of these three portfolios, and you can get any of these on an ETF or a mutual fund. You could just buy this. This whole idea, well, I manage a portfolio of my own stocks, and I really have to watch that all the time. You're nuts. Quit that. Go find a life. Go outdoors. Notice the sun. You just buy a portfolio. It is automatically, massively well-diversified. The only thing that's left in there is relevant risk. And so there you are. And a couple of things. You now have seen how you use Excel to pull big data or copy and paste it. And then notice that I didn't use any high-powered econometrics, PhD-level crap. All I did was some simple statistics, and there you are. There's your portfolio analysis. Now, remember, there are a couple of things that I do want to bring up. Your portfolio weights come in. In other words, each stock will have a certain amount of weight in the total portfolio. Use the market weights. In other words, price times your number of shares. And then for the weights of the different stocks, if you have a small portfolio. In a portfolio of this size, it doesn't matter. The weights really don't matter that much at all. And in ETFs and mutual funds, the managers always put the portfolios in the proper weights and keep them there. Another important thing is that, okay, the expected return to a portfolio is just the weighted average of the returns to the individual portfolio components. However, the standard deviation of the portfolio is not the weighted average of the standard deviations of the individual parts of the portfolio. Let me say that again. The standard deviation of a portfolio of stocks is not the weighted average of the individual standard deviations of the stocks. You can't do that because there's this little factor that happens. When two stocks are put together, their standard deviations tend to be independent, but their correlation makes them have a greater amount of risk than the two stocks individually. Let me say that again. You've got two stocks, Sigma 1, Sigma 2. When you put them together in a portfolio, the two sigmas create their own, each of the sigmas makes its own risk. But then the two stocks working together actually create an additional risk if they're positively correlated. So, for example, you, madam, are an axe murderess. You, sir, are an arsonist. Okay? Now, I put the two of you together. It's not just the risk of murder and arson. There's also you feeding each other. Yeah, let me burn down a house. Can I axe murder people first? Sure. That'll keep them from calling 911 for the fire department. So you two are more of a risk together than you are separately. Everyone. You heard the story about the guy, country truck driver driving down a lonely road one night, and he sees this young man hitchhiking, and the guy stops and picks him up, and the kid says, I really appreciate you doing this. You know, so many people have driven by me because, you know, they think I'm some kind of a serial killer. And the driver says, well, that's just not going to happen. What's the chance that two people in a car are going to both be serial killers? Yeah, that one didn't go over too well at all. The hell with you guys. Anyway. Now, I want to show you something here. This is a site called PortfolioVisualizer.com. And it's at PortfolioVisualizer.com, all one word, /asset-correlations. This is where you can find the correlation coefficient between two stocks. Now, a correlation coefficient of 1 would mean that the stocks move exactly together. A correlation of 0 means that they have no relationship whatsoever. A correlation that's negative, which is very unusual to find, means that they actually move in opposite directions to a greater or lesser extent to each other. The goal is, if you're building a portfolio, to find stocks that have low correlations. In other words, they don't feed each other too much. They're going to feed each other. You are almost never going to find stocks that have zero correlation or negative correlation. They're going to feed each other. Now, that is not true. There are gold mining stocks that will have negative correlations with normal stocks. But, I mean, unless you're really into taking your chances with gold, leave those alone. So I'm going to put in some stocks here and show you how the visualizer works. So I'm going to put in Netflix, NFLX, Caterpillar, Facebook, Kellogg, Ford, Target. Anyone got any more? Yes. Okay. A.
Walmart.
A. PPL. WMT. I am not going to put Tesla. Well, yeah, actually, let me put. That's enough. It's going to get weird here.
Apple's
what?
Apple's.
That's right. Apple.
Target and Walmart might be too well correlated.
No. We want to see difference, different types of correlation. So that would be fine. Let's have a look and see. Okay, now just leave these alone. This is good enough. Boom. Here's your correlation matrix. Now, obviously, it's the numbers down here will be the mirror of these up here. But here's your correlation matrix. Okay, now, Netflix and Caterpillar. Now, you're going to have different people tell you the different rules. My rule is stay away from correlations above 0.3. Others would say 0.5. Some would say 0.2. And you'll find if you do this, you'll get your own kind of like thoughts. So Netflix and Caterpillar, clearly they're not too much related to each other because they're in completely different industries. Netflix and Facebook are not related. Netflix, and you might say, well, that's a little surprising. Not really, because Netflix is a loner's kind of thing. You Netflix and chill. I mean, as you get older, you'll find out that you're more like me. You don't like people too much, so you go home and watch Netflix with your cats. Yeah, go ahead. And why would that be? Because they're both in the heavies.
But Ford and Tesla are less related.
Ford and Tesla, that's because Ford is actually a successful company with normal people running it. No, it's kind of interesting, though. You're right. You would expect those to have a higher correlation. They're both car companies. However, Tesla, people think of that as the car company. The part of Tesla that's actually probably going to be successful and survive isn't the car company. It's the electric generating company, that company that makes the generators and all those new age things like that. Yeah, and that's Tesla. That's why, I mean, the honest thing is, I had a Tesla in front of me at Chick-fil-A. Guy ordered two Chick-fil-A's, extra pickles, but have you seen a Tesla car in real life? They're beautiful. I mean, they're actually gorgeous cars. But I mean, is that going to win? Well, ask DeLorean about that. But, okay, now look at a couple. Now, let's look, for example, Netflix actually is low correlation with everything. Interestingly, Netflix would be a good addition to a portfolio. You're talking about the risk equivalence and all of that. Do you see how it's poorly correlated with everything else? It's like in its own world. Caterpillar, obviously with Ford. Now, here's one. Apple and Caterpillar have a 0.34. Here's something that's just going to happen. And I actually aimed at stocks like this. I'm glad someone said Apple. There's sometimes a correlation, you got nothing. Why are these at a higher correlation? 0.34 isn't that high, but it's still higher than I would want to put those two into a portfolio together. So the question is, why would those two, for heaven's sakes, why would Caterpillar be, my God, look at Caterpillar and Facebook. You know, that's one of those, the hell is that? How does that happen? Yeah. You know, there is a possibility, and I really wish you hadn't brought that up, okay, that sometimes you'll get a washing effect. All ships in the same ocean rise and fall together kind of thing. I really wish that didn't happen, but it is there that... you'll have in the same index, everything gets pulled together at least to some extent. But going through here, Facebook and Target, they are very different, obviously, and look at those correlations. Those would be beautiful in a portfolio together. Similarly, Facebook and Walmart. Now let's get down here, and someone brought this up. Target and Walmart. Yep. Target and Walmart, because they're both consumer retail, they are going to be highly correlated with each other. That does not mean that they're bad companies, but you probably want to choose one or the other for a portfolio addition based upon the beta that you wanted to construct in the portfolio and other matters. But if I were to look down here at Ford, obviously CAT, but other than CAT, Ford is actually poorly correlated with the others in this portfolio. Now I'm going to do an interesting one up here. I'm going to put one more in here. Gold. Barely any correlation, and notice that it even has a negative correlation with Target. Yeah, in a portfolio, it's not going to cause any more relevant risk, non-diversifiable risk. It is just gold is what you go to when all of the other things are going to hell. So, yeah, in a portfolio, I mean, if you want to ride that dog, gold is, and by the way, I'm talking about gold, that's a stock. G-O-L-D is a stock. And there are other ones, too, that are like it. Now, interestingly, let me put one more in here. BA. Oh, hell, what am I thinking? Yeah, BAC. 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 Notice that it has an odd. Isn't that odd? Oh, no, it's not odd at all. No, there's something. But think about it this way. You're going to buy a car, right?
I'm going to get a loan for your bank.
You're going to get a loan for it. Most likely it's going to be a bank loan. And so a company that is heavily dependent upon people borrowing money to buy the products of the company is going to ride with the banks themselves. Okay? In other words, Ford has its own financing, but that financing is connected with the banks, the big banks. So, yeah. Those banks are not going to be a good idea with companies that rely heavily upon borrowing by the customers. Just not going to have, not a good idea at all. Yeah, go ahead. With which one? I see it. Financing. Caterpillar. Finance is through them. Apple, to some extent, because I mean, okay, let's try Apple. How do you own an iPhone? Is it an iPhone?
Yeah.
How much does that thing cost?
$1,000. Yeah.
Did you buy it with cash? You financed it. You probably financed it through your phone service provider, right? Okay. That phone service provider is not financing your phone. That phone service provider is doing the financing through a bank. It gets its money up front. It's like those of you who have some kind of financing, they're letting you pay some of your tuition and then more of your tuition. No, we get all of our tuition up front and it's financed. That's why they charge you a fee if you don't pay your money on time, because we're getting the money up front from a bank. Okay? So anytime there's any kind of a consumer product that requires financing, it ultimately is going to derive that financing from a bank, not from something else, not from your mobile service provider. Verizon's not financing you. They say they are, but they are actually getting the money up front, and all they're doing is taking your payments and moving them through to where they got the loan on your behalf. That's just how it works. Good point, though, and as you can see, so that's one of the great ways that you can explain the different correlations that stocks have. Now, ultimately, as you buy more and more stocks, their correlations, if you're trying to buy a portfolio of 30 stocks, you need to watch out for this, the correlation coefficients. Because essentially every time you add another stock, the correlation of within the whole portfolio will probably ease up, but not that much. But if you buy a massive portfolio in an ETF or a mutual fund, you don't have to worry about the correlations. That's their job. And if you're a finance major, this might be your job in such an organization, dealing with the correlation coefficients, balancing the portfolio, keeping it on track. But one thing that I do want to bring up to you, let me try this real quick here. Excel. Nope, that's not what I wanted. File. Did any of those recover? Nope. A last point on the portfolio control. You notice that over a long period of time, buy and hold, just buying and holding the stupid portfolio is going to get you a darn nice return. Over a period of 20, 30, 40 years, just a well-balanced, massive portfolio is going to pull you somewhere between 9.5% and 15%, nearly 15% per year. And if you do that, just buy and hold and don't panic, don't run during the down times, and don't get all excited and buy stupidly in the up markets. Just buy and hold and just keep putting money in every month or every 6 months or every year. You're going to have a decent return. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that's exactly right. You see, because there's in higher powered finance, there is a parameter that drives long-term stock returns. It's called Tobin's Q. Now, Tobin's Q was stable for decades. In other words, the return could be relied upon over long periods of time. Year over year over year. Tobin's Q, it's sort of like high energy physics. We can't see Tobin's Q directly, but we can calculate it. We can figure out what it is. We know that Tobin's Q has slipped. In the 21st century, it's gone down. So those returns that your grandparents and parents would have realized over long buy and hold periods are somewhat higher than what you will be able to get doing the same exact strategy over your lifetimes. It's not dramatically lower, but it's enough that it will substantially impact what you can expect to have in retirement by a buy and hold strategy. In other words, your parents will eat cat food in their old age. You, on the other hand, we'll be lucky if you can buy Alpo generic dog food. That's just something to give you some hope for the future because I'm that kind of guy. Now I'm going to give you a quiz and we're going to end this for the night.